Thanks for listening on Friday, September 19th, 2014. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. And it is a Federal News Radio All-Star edition of the Federal News Countdown this week. My colleague Jason Miller, Federal News Radio Executive Editor, thanks for being on the Countdown today as always.
It's good to be back.
And it's nice to have you back. And we have a rookie on the Federal News Countdown today. It is our colleague Tom Temin from the Federal Drive. Thank you for staying late today. It is terrific to have you on the program.
Let me put my pom-poms down. Yes, it is great to be on here. Actually, I was on a couple of years ago.
I don't even remember it.
I think it must have been maybe another administration.
That could be the case. You have each chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we've linked them up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We start, of course, where we always do with...
Number three!
Jason Miller, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is a team effort. It is by our Shefali Kapadia, Emily Kopp, Julia Ziegler, and Michael O'Connell. And the headline is Continuing Resolution Heads for President Obama for Signature. I'm struck by the fact that you stuck this at number three when the fact that there's going to be no government shutdown this year, I would think, might be higher up on your list.
Well, I think part of the reason why I put it only as number three is because, yes, it's important, but we kind of knew this was going to happen. There was definitely signs that they were not in the mood for another shutdown. There was definitely signs that they did not want to, you know, have another showdown over different things. So the fact is, it's good. It's important. It's a newsworthy story, but it's not the top newsworthy story of the week.
And we'll get to that, later in the program. This gets us through December 11th. There are some flexibilities for some of the agencies. Customs and Border Protection and ICE will be able to move money around if they need to staff the border. It includes export-import bank extension through June 30th of next year. So a few stragglers here that don't make it, I guess, a textbook CR that is exactly extending the money.
I don't think they ever do that.
There are always a few things here and there. Does this give us any sense, do you think, of what we can expect in the lame duck session to try to get us from December 12th through September 30th, 2015?
I think what this does is gets the Congress through the election in November, and then as they come back in December, whoever, if the Democrats lose control of the Senate and the Republicans, you know, have both houses of Congress, that changes the lame duck session. If it continues to be a split houses of Congress, then that also changes the lame duck session. So I think all of this was about is keeping the government running, getting us through the election, and then we'll see what happens. But I think that the lame duck session in of itself is when you look at some of the other bills that got passed, the Senior Executive Service Accountability Act, some of the IRS's Accountability Act, the VA Construction Assistance Act, for instance, I think those are setting the tone as well for the lame duck session to see these are bills passed by the House. What does the Senate pick up? And then there's also some Senate bills that got passed late yesterday, such as Boots on the Ground for Cybersecurity at DHS, Workforce Act. How's that going to get picked up by the House? Because they all have some similar bills in there.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jason Miller, is headlined Continuing Resolution Heads to President Obama for Signature. You can find it and all the stories from the Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Tom Temin, your choice at number three is from federalnewsradio.com. NASA picks Boeing and SpaceX to ferry astronauts. This is interesting from a procurement point of view, aside from the NASA and rockets going into space perspective, I think, don't you?
Well, that's right. I think the reason this is important is not because of SpaceX and Boeing and rocketry. I think it's important because finally NASA has shown that it can set a direction and get something done. What was a signature federal agency, signature federal effort for so many decades, has really lost its way in many ways in recent years. And now, I think the nadir was reached after the shuttle program closed. In the United States, the power of the world was dependent on Russia for taxi service to the International Space Station. So I think this represents a turnaround for a major agency and something that has always had the imagination of Americans. So that's why I think it has importance beyond the simple fact of a contract being awarded. And also, it's a major change in the sense that it is going to be privately operated, so it's still a taxi service, but now we have that in the United States. So I think that says a lot.
The contract part of it, though, I think is interesting, too, because of the dichotomy of the two companies that are involved here. Boeing, you couldn't think of a more mainline, textbook, old-school company. It's a very large company, and they do things in a very traditional way, as they've done them for many years. SpaceX is Elon Musk, the guy behind Tesla, and he made his fortune in PayPal, the online payment service. And they really are looking at things a completely different way. Part of the reason that he's achieved some success in getting this contract, some people believe, is because he had the guts to actually sue the government to be considered for this contract in the first place.
Well, I think Elon Musk has discovered, yeah, there was great money in PayPal, but the real money is where taxpayer dollars are. That's been part of the success of Tesla, which is subsidized, and his battery plants are state subsidies and so forth. So why not? And yes, so this is an annuity for his company. And I think, though, on the other hand, he did have something to offer that was real. And I think it's also interesting that how far rocketry and this what was considered almost unattainable technology, except for very few companies, is that much more democratized now. We're still not where, you know, you and I can go to space at the, by hailing a taxi. But it is a step closer to that kind of long-term human dream.
So, how cool would Uber for space be?
Yeah, that's right.
And in fact, what's interesting about this article is that there's three contenders. So Sierra Nevada Corporation was the third one. They actually lost out. So I think we got to watch out for, okay, is there going to be a bid protest? Because this is a huge, I mean, if you look at this, this is $7 billion almost worth of money going to these two companies, not quite split evenly. But, you know, Sierra Nevada's got to look at this and go, oh, whoa, 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 where's my piece? Because if we feel like if they felt like their bid is up to, was up to par, which I'm sure they do, that would be interesting because this also could delay this movement because this is not going to happen for a few years. I mean, I can't quite tell here, but it's not, you know, the goal is 2017, so that's a few, that's still 2 years out or more.
Well, that's right. There could be a protest, and on the although if this is something that's going to be the mode of space travel for a long time, you know, Sierra Nevada could be heard from again.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Tom Temin, is NASA picks Boeing and SpaceX to ferry astronauts. You can find that story and all of our stories on the Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Jason Miller and Tom Temin on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Tom Temin and Jason Miller. And we are up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Tom Temin, is from defense.gov. It's the DOD's website, and the headline is DOD to send 25-bed hospital to Liberia in the fight against Ebola virus. And the idea here, Tom, it's not so much these 25 beds, it's just the fact that the government is mobilizing to the level that it is to fight a virus that right now is confined to Africa primarily, but that everybody seems to be worried could spread all over the world very quickly.
I think the story is interesting on a lot of levels. One, there are more boots on the air and in the ground and wherever else they will be in Africa dealing with Ebola than there are purportedly in Iraq dealing with ISIS. So I just thought that was an interesting fact. No judgment there, but plenty of people are making it, but I just thought it was interesting. And second, I think it's amazing how much of an all-of-government effort this has become for the United States, because I think people tend to think, well, it's over there, too bad, but it's not really my problem. But I think what the president is trying to say, and I think what the epidemiologists will tell you and what, you know, the CDC people have been saying is that, you know, it's one 747 flight away from landing here and blooming. And so I think it's it shows – you know, in some ways, we are so sophisticated and technologically advanced, and yet the civilization veneer covering up things like horrible viruses and bacteria that can kill thousands or millions even. I mean, that's not unprecedented in human history, is just below the surface. And so we have to be ever vigilant. And I think this is indication of something really serious.
Jason, a huge development in the Ebola story in the federal government. We'll talk about that later in the program, so don't give away the end of the show. But the effort that Tom is talking about across government, it's been a while since we've seen, I think, the variety of agencies that are mixed together in this mix. Mixed together in this way. Is it fair? Is that fair to say?
No, I think that's fair. And in fact, I'll even go one step further than what Tom was saying. It's not just a whole of government. It's really a whole of world. I mean, if you think about the World Health Organization, a lot of the Western Europe is involved. They're sending people. They're sending help. So I think that they, I think everybody's realizing Tom's point that we are all one 747 flight away from, from this bigger outspread. I mean, this is probably the, what are we in the 21st, 22nd century? I always lose count of that. 21st century plague, you know, when you think about the plague that killed, you know, 50 million in Europe. You know, not that I want to over dramatize anything, but, you know, as you saw what happens, it takes a lot of medical care. And I think there's only a certain number of countries, and the U.S. is one of them, thankfully, that can go and provide this much support. And you're right. I mean, it's not just DOD and CDC, but you probably will get USAID in there. You'll get State Department involved. This is one of those, is one of the few things that really does bring the government together and shows not just the power of the U.S., but the power and the thoughtfulness and the talent that the U.S. government has. And I think that gets lost in the discussion many times.
Well, I think you made a point there, too, that's valid, that as many other countries might be able to, China probably could do it, Russia probably could do it, but they don't, and we do.
The deeper implication here for the Defense Department, I think, should be noted, and that is, how do you plan in planning documents for an Ebola virus or something like that? I mean, where do you put that in a QDR or one of these other planning documents that you expect, you know, when you're thinking about your strategy for the next 4 years? Now, I recognize $30 million in program funding, as this story says, in the scheme, in the scope of the broader defense budget is not that big a deal. But there are still resources that are going to Africa that can't be someplace else right now.
And in fact, going, just talking about the dollar figures for a second, in the continuing resolution that we just talked about, there's actually $88 million that HHS is getting for emergency needs. So when you talk about planning for stuff like this, they do have a contingency fund, and DOD has contingency contracting dollars. But that's why Congress had to get involved with the CR and add that $88 million plus up, because they realize, and I think the administration has done a decent job of explaining to Congress why this money is needed. So I think it's not planned. I just think they know it's the rainy day fund.
But I'm not just thinking about it operationally, although that is certainly an important way to think about it. I'm also thinking about it logistically. And how do you decide that you're going to do be able to execute various operations? We hear conversations all the time, Tom, about readiness and what are we ready for and how are we going to prepare for it. And there will be, inevitably, things that will happen in the coming decade as sequestration plays itself out that will require response, just as your choice in this story requires response.
Well, that's right. And so I think the that gets to that whole idea of resiliency, you know, and the ability to respond. I mean, as far as the money is concerned, you know, if all else fails, there's always supplemental requests. And, you know, that's where the, you know, I had earlier today, as a matter of fact, I had a couple of CFOs on a special panel. And they talked about the idea of they are the locus of understanding of appropriations law, and they can really help you get something done. And so when you need to get something done like this, there are ways, whether reprogramming or supplementals or whatever the case might be. I mean, ultimately, the government can do what it needs to do. But I think the idea of that operational resiliency, the ability to marshal forces, is really impressive. And so I mean, that's one reason why people, I think, worry whether the DOD will be cut back so far that they can't do something like that if needed.
Tom Temin's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from defense.gov. DOD to send 25-bed hospital to Liberia in fight against Ebola virus. Jason Miller, your choice at number two is from federalnewsradio.com. DOD hunting for value, innovation, not just lowest price. We're learning today about the Better Buying Power 3.0 initiative. Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for ATL, releasing it at the Center for Strategic and International Studies today. And the details, of course, will come out as time goes on. But I was struck by the response that we saw this morning from some industry groups that are already saying, mechanically, this seems to be fine. It doesn't really seem to do much to address the long-term conceptual ideas that a lot of people in industry and in government have talked about reforming defense acquisition.
And I think better buying power is not supposed to address those long-term. I think they are very much a short-term vision. Mm-hmm. I think the House and Senate Armed Services Committees are working on the longer-term vision around DOD acquisition. And really, if you think about more broadly, government-wide acquisition, because as I like to say, anything that starts in DOD eventually trickles down to the civilian world. But Better Buying Power 3 is really DOD saying, what can we do now? What can we do within policy, regulations, within just culture that can make a difference today? And a couple things are basic stuff. Minimum capabilities, affordable innovations is one of the key themes of Better Buying Power 3. Another one is, how can we reduce barriers of entry for new companies to give DOD new technologies or new skills or new services. And I think some of that stuff is just, let's think about things differently. And I think that's what Better Buying Power version 1 and 2 tried to do. I think 1 went too far with lowest price technically acceptable LPTA, and 2 brought them back a little bit going, okay, we thought too much about this and how can we fix it? I'm sure Better Buying Power 3 is also going to fix some of the missteps or things that have gone too far in number 2 and 1 as well.
Some of the requirement stuff in this, Tom, makes a lot of sense, but it strikes me that some of the requirement stuff isn't brand new. I mean, I had a Rear Admiral from the Coast Guard in the program this week talking about their cutter program, and he said one of the things they very deliberately did was set out requirements at the beginning and then stayed bound and determined to stick with those requirements through the course of all 8 of the cutters. Now, they've got 3 of them at sea. The 4th one goes, if it hasn't within the last couple of days, it will go within the next couple of days. So they're halfway through this program, and they're coming through pretty much on time and pretty much on budget. And they're building them in the same shipyards in Mississippi that Ingalls builds Navy ships that are not having the same track record of success. So some of the things that we see here are some of the things that are working other places already in government.
Well, that's right. Requirements always are at the heart of programs that go out of the way. And, you know, ultimately, it's a factor of time. And so, the Better Buying Power is focusing on the people side of it. You know, there have been a lot of regulations and provisions in the appropriations, the authorizations laws for DOD in the last couple of years to work on the process part of it. But, you know, the process is whatever you want to make of it. So it does get back to people ultimately. And so whether it's Better Buying Power, whether the words we use change from era to era, but the point is, how can you get it down to requirements that everybody can understand and then deliver when you say you're going to deliver? I mean, this has been the VA's abiding theme, too, is faster to delivery. And that means always you have to have clear requirements.
There are 2 points that I take away from the speech that Frank Kendall gave this morning and the coverage that you can find at federalnewsradio.com right now. One is the devil's in the details. As we learn more about the specific wording, Jason, that Mr. Kendall put out, we'll understand it better and we'll be able to handicap the possibility of success a lot better. But execution's part of the thing here. I mean, what we've seen with 1.0 and 2.0, the same things that we've seen at some of the things that OFPP's put out about procurement and acquisition, and that is, can you get people to actually do it once you put the policy in place?
And the thing about DOD that I think works better than what happens in the civilian world around that point you just made, Francis, is they do understand the chain of command. In the civilian world, I think the chain of command is not as strong, and I think people just don't salute and move forward. They question, which is good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, coming from a journalist who questions probably way too many things. But at the same time, I think when you come up with something like Better Buying Power 3 with a whole new set of ideas, a culture change, you do kind of need some of that, yes, sir, I'll do this. And it's going to take a lot of time. And I think that's why we're up to version 3 now. And we're not just stuck on version 1. They're course correcting as they see needed. And they're moving forward with ideas that have come out both from earlier versions and from industry and from Congress.
Jason Miller's choice at number 3 is the release of Better Buying Power 3.0 from the Department of Defense. You can read more about it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back on the Federal News Countdown, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jason Miller and Tom Temin on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose, the 3 most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by 2 experts in the world of the federal government. This week it's Tom Temin from the Federal Drive and Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller, and we are up to
#1.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Tom Temin, is from federalnewsradio.com, the continuing resolution headed to President Obama's desk. And we talked about this a little bit earlier when our colleague Jason decided to stick this all the way down at the very bottom of the countdown, Tom. You have it in a more appropriate spot, I think, for its import. And the idea that we will be out of the shutdown business at least until the middle of December, I think, is significant. But the planning and certainty, it's not what we would like, of course. We would like to see a full year regular order appropriated budget. But I guess given where we've been the last couple of years, it's better than nothing, right?
Well, it is better than nothing. It's certainly better than the shutdown we had last year. And so in that sense, you know, federal agencies can continue to operate. But, you know, it's always disappointing somehow. And I think it's big news of the week because it shows where the government's headed for the next 3 months and at least a clue to where it's going to go for the next year. So that's why I put it as number one. But, you know, I would have agreed with Jason, maybe number two or three, but whatever, it happened. So the question is what they do with it and mm-hmm. what Congress does when it comes back, because this is one of those years when they do return, it will be the lame ducks when they get, that is not when they come back, but when they get back after December 11th, mm-hmm. when they deal with it, they'll yeah. be lame ducks. And so in some ways, you know, a lame duck, anything can happen. People that might be elected but headed out. There might be a few of those. We don't know.
There's a lot of people who are retiring. Absolutely.
There's right. some retirees, and then there's some that'll lose and some that'll win. So I think it's just sort of like the toss-up, and we'll see what the real serve looks like later on.
Now, Senator Reid has already said, Jason, he will bring the Senate back right after Veterans Day. So that gives you about a calendar month. I don't know how many work days he intends to schedule, but it gives him about a calendar month to start whatever they're going to do on their side, or if passed as prologue, then they'll do nothing until the House sends them something to vote on. So there still is some uncertainty about what happens after December 11th, it seems.
Absolutely, and I think that there's already probably negotiations happening now about what happens after December 11th and how to get for the rest of fiscal year 15 done. And I think the big question is what happens on whatever the election day is, November 3rd, 4th, 2nd, whatever yeah. that Tuesday is. And I think what's going to happen is that's going to really set the tail for the 14th. I think that's why he's going to spread it out between Election Day and Veterans Day, because that's when the negotiations heat up. Because, again, if the Senate switches parties into the Republicans, that's a whole new set of negotiations that begins to happen, and then the White House gets involved. What I've heard from both agencies and vendors is they need that certainty. And I think Congress recognized that, you know, having a shutdown once every 20 years is probably all they can handle, and giving – that type of certainty to both business and government is so important. So I think that we're not sure what's going to happen, but they're not going to shut down again. They may do a series of continuing resolutions, a month here, 6 weeks there, and gets them into, you know, passed into January.
They might even patch it shorter than that, Tom. We might get to December 11th and see one that's 48 hours or 3 days or a week or whatever to give them whatever little bargaining time they think they need.
That's right. 6 days left till Christmas, you yeah. know, type of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the things that I think, I know we don't do politics or to a great degree on this station, but I've seen, some ads and some, campaign talking points that indicate, well, if you give the Republicans the Senate back, we'll restore the function. And, we saw plenty of times when both parties have controlled both houses where you still don't get budget bills done. It's not a guarantee that we're going to see any kind of regular order because both parties control both houses.
That's
or
right.
One party controls both houses.
That's correct.
Me.
I think what we've shown in the last generation is that neither party is very good at governing. And when they get together and get the cookie jars, they can get things done, but, you know, it's either steamrolling people and so that there's no compromise involved, or it's totally dysfunctional. And so, yes, that's right. In a bipartisan sense, they're both very good at non-governing. And, you know, the problem with the CRs that I see, too, is for the industry, government gets very conservative in terms of spending and in terms of what they're willing to do. Nobody wants to be in an anti-deficiency situation, mm-hmm. and it's very easy to hide behind the CR to do nothing, even though there's actually a lot of discretionary spending out there. If you understand apportionment and appropriation law, that backs up what you can do with procurement. But very few people know that. So that's a good time to, you know, understand some of that stuff, use your CFO. Some of the vendors know their way around it better than some of the people in the agencies.
Now, what I'm hearing there, Tom, is the words by another name, the trickle-down theory is in real life here, where, yes, if the vendors do not, you know, if the government goes conservative, vendors then go conservative in terms of hiring, in terms mm-hmm. of spending, and it trickles down all the way down to your local dry cleaners, your local fast food restaurants.
Your local radio stations.
Your local radio stations. Exactly.
It's the same argument that was made about sequestration.
Yes.
You know, and remember the Aerospace Industrial Association put out this study that if sequestration happened, 2 million people would lose their jobs or something like that. And I'm not suggesting any kind of a conflab like that, but that's what you're getting at, right?
I think that everyone wants the certainty, and I think Congress accepts that. The other point I was going to make around what you just said regarding the budget process, I think that's why the argument is really growing about can the federal government do a budget process that's different? Because this one just doesn't work, and it hasn't worked, and it's not going to work. And I think one of the most interesting things I've heard about this budget process and why there's so much dysfunction in Congress, not just about budget, but generally speaking, it was about earmarks. And you know, people always give earmarks a bad name, but that was
the
chip.
Word for them now.
That was the bargaining chip. You give me what I want, I'll give you what I want, and we get something done. Mm-hmm. Now there's no reason. Well, you're not giving me anything. I'm not going to give you anything, so nothing gets done. And I think that's shown in the probes process as well.
But I wonder if there's any political stomach on either side to be the person that stands up and says, yeah, I'm in favor of bringing earmarks back. I have a hard time seeing that.
No, and I think that some of the processes of yesteryear and some of the positions people take on yesteryear when things were closer together on left and right, up and down, whatever you want to call it. But I think that things have gotten more extreme, and you know, we didn't see when there was horse trading over the earmarks and so forth, and they still happen. There's a new word for them. I forget what it is. But you didn't have the level of debt and the vast scale of things that we have now, and I think that's part of what's caused this logjam.
What is the outcome that we expect to see here? Jason, let's start with you. Do you think we'll get a CR that takes us up to the end of the fiscal 15, or are we going to see potentially something in between? There are all kinds of permutations possible, I suppose.
I see at least one, if not two more CRs that get us through, you know, kind of the beginning of January, the when the Congress comes back into session in January after the State of the Union, mm-hmm. you get one, as you said, you know, that gets us a week after December 11th, and then maybe you get a month one or 2 months one that gets us to late January. And then I think they fix it. I think because then you have the party in place, the White House has had time for negotiations, and if the House is split or if the House has remained all in one party, mm-hmm. then there's time for that negotiation to happen.
Okay. Tom, what do you think?
Well, what's going to happen after December 11th? I think you might see, as you said earlier, maybe another series of small bites until they do come to their senses. And so I'm anxious to see the new session when they get going in January and, you know, after everybody's inaugurated into their new offices. I think, I don't know, maybe the people coming in that are, if the party does change, it's going to be different people. Maybe I'm hoping against hope. I don't like to be Pollyanna, and people know that I'm probably the least one like that there is.
I would say that's fair, yes.
But I still have this hope that perhaps maybe they'll say, you know what, we've got to find a better way through this.
You guys have more guts than I do. The only prediction that I'm going to make is that sometime after, a couple of weeks after December 11th will be Christmas, and then the week right after that will be New Year's. That's all I'm going for.
And the sun will come up tomorrow.
The sun will come up. But don't sing that, please.
I will not.
Tom Temin's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Continuing resolution heads to President Obama for signature. Shefali Kapadia, Emily Kopp, Julia Ziegler, and Michael O'Connell putting that on federalnewsradio.com. And all of the stories from the countdown are at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, we wrap up this week's federal news countdown with Jason Miller's choice for the most important federal news story of the week on In-Depth with Francis Rose. You're listening to the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown has the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Jason Miller and by Tom Temin. And Jason, your choice at number one this week is headlined, Federal CIO Van Roekel leaving post for new role at USAID. The byline, interestingly enough, Tom, is Jason Miller. So that's a nice coincidence there.
You know it's a rarity that I only pick my own stories rarely. But
no, that's true. You're not like Soloway, who always chooses stories that he's quoted in every time he's on
or
the countdown
show. Or his
column
from other magazines.
Exactly.
Hey, honey,
right.
Here I am again.
Yeah, that's right.
In the publication.
I have to say, the email that I didn't get a chance to even send you this morning when we first learned about this was, because you have this story up very early on federalnewsradio.com this morning. The email I wanted to send you and didn't get a chance to was, did anybody see this coming? Did we have any sense that something like this was going to happen?
So the rumor mill kind of has come and gone with Steve, whether he's leaving. There's a pretty strong rumor that he was looking for a bigger, better role, a deputy secretary, an undersecretary for management, even deputy director for management at OMB. But there was no sense that it was happening anytime soon. So when Beth Colbert got named over at OMB to be the deputy director for management, people kind of felt like, well, Steve's probably in a pretty good role. He's got a lot of power in that regard. It's a good position for him. So for him to take a step that, you know, and I'll be honest, this is not a lateral move. This is not like, Tom, you remember this D. Lee going from OFPP to head of defense acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is not that. This is, in many regards, you could say a step down. And, you know, 3 years in his position as federal CIO, maybe it's time. So maybe it's not that big of a deal. And let's be honest, Steve's accomplished. I mean, it's not like he's a new guy who is trying to look for his next thing. He could probably be done with working if
right.
he wanted
yeah,
to.
He doesn't need to do this.
So
well,
he's
doing it because he thinks it's important.
I think so. I think that's the key, Francis, that he's doing it because he thinks he can help and it's important and it's a different type of role than what he's done for the last 3 years.
Yeah, my thought was that if you look at Steve's career, Microsoft and then doing some of the White House work, especially the cybersecurity, and now moving over to USAID, the theme seems to be viruses. But, you know, kidding aside, I think you're right. I think that he doesn't, you know, clearly not motivated by money sticking around with the federal government this long. And doesn't seem to be motivated by power or prestige because, frankly, you know, except in our world, nobody's heard of the federal CIO. And so now this is a little bit more visible, even if it's not as high ranking. And I think it is a chance to do good in a way that people from that digerati like him see as helping something that's really, really important. So I wish him luck. I hope it works out. You know, his digital piece does contribute to eradicating or mitigating this horrible problem.
Jason, you write on federalnewsradio.com, Van Roekel's been federal CIO since August 2011 after previously serving at USAID and the Federal Communications Commission. So he's kind of going home in one sense.
Well, I think that he spent a fair amount of time at USAID where he actually worked on some challenges within there's a 2011 crisis around the Horn of Africa that he was part of the government's response. So I think – so he has some experience in helping with crises. But I think what he's seen is what can I bring from a data standpoint? There's a ton of data, and how can I bring that expertise to making better – helping the government make better decisions? Because he's not going to be on the ground in West Africa. And, you know, he's not going to be on the ground dealing with Ebola. I mean, that's where the CDC and State Department and USAID will do it. But he can help them make better decisions based on using data. And I think that data analytics has proven well. I mean, I remember doing a story with the folks at CDC, with other agencies, where they've used this to help understand where the outbreaks could happen or mm-hmm. did happen and how to respond to them.
NIH has used data pretty significantly inside the United States on flu and things like that as well.
Correct. And that helps the people say, where do we need to get our resources mm-hmm. to and how quickly?
Well, I think, too, they can overlay the outbreak data on other local data that might be there, geographic information system. I mean, it's a primitive country, but there are water supplies and electricity supplies and roadways and alleyways and housing types so that maybe they can correlate those things to predict where this might go next.
And you know what's fascinating? You're correct that these are third world countries in many cases, Tom, but in some cases their digital infrastructure is better than ours because they haven't had to overcome any legacy infrastructure.
They skipped the telephone.
Yeah, they're built. They've got no copper wire in most of these countries. It's all digital and it's all cellular, and so their data collection capabilities are in some cases as good as ours and maybe better because they don't have that legacy infrastructure layer in between.
Well, there's also research techniques that have shown that if you can get people to be wired up, that is to have a mobile device on them,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the information they broadcast can be used in a big data format to predict very, very fine-grained behaviors, such as, you know, people that like a certain flavor of ice cream. This has been proven in some of the academic settings, and so maybe this is what they'll apply over there.
Tom likes hot sauce on his ice cream. I just want to put that on
the record. That doesn't surprise me at all. It's completely within the realm of believability.
Let me circle back around to one thing, though. But the fact
is Tabasco.
And Tabasco. Hot sauce, Tabasco. Oh. Yeah, same thing. With Steve leaving the White House, though, this does open up a position, and it's a little bit of a head-scratcher because this administration's got roughly 2 years left. Who's going to come in for those 2 years, especially on an agenda that's fairly mature
mm-hmm.
and there's not a lot of time, not a lot of political capital to really kick off anything new? It is an interesting decision he's made. And on top of that, both of the top two technology people have now left the OMB. Todd Park leaving, obviously mm-hmm. Megan Smith's in, but she's brand new to government.
Right.
So what does that also mean for the agenda going forward when when you have the two leaders who've been there and Todd has been in government for a long time? You know, he started at HHS as a CTO. That tells you something. Okay, how are they going to move things forward? Because mm-hmm. they're losing a lot of that relationships, the political capital, or just the knowledge of how government works.
I had that same conversation this week with a non-IT official, but somebody at one of a very high level of the cabinet of a cabinet agency who's in line to move to another cabinet agency for the last couple of years of the administration. And this person said that's the struggle that this person's agency is having, the agency that this person is to go to. This is. We're starting to get to that point. And this person said, You can still do something in 2 years. You can still make a difference in 2 years, but the window's starting to close. And so as time progresses, the idea of having somebody come into an administration to do anything more than just kind of be a caretaker, to be there when the lights go out in 2017, is going to be more and more difficult. It's going to be harder to find people who are willing to do that, I think.
If I was the administration and I wanted to get things done, I would put career people in those jobs at this point.
And I think that's what's going to end up happening. In fact, in over the next 6 months, as politicals leave, they're just going to slide in that career person and say, you're acting for the next year.
Well, and that was actually, you anticipated my question. Are they going to actually give them the titles, though, and give them the autonomy, or are they going to make them acting?
Depends, because there's rules about how long you can be in an acting position. There's a 240-day rule or so many months rule.
Right.
So it all depends. But getting through someone through the confirmation process, I mean, think about whoever's going to replace Steve Van Roekel. They have to be vetted. They have to be nominated. They have to.
Yeah.
It may take them 6 months or 8 months.
Middle of 2015 until they get in there.
Yeah, yeah. And then then they're really only there for about six or 8 months.
Yeah, then you're looking at a 12 to 18 month period. And that's if that 2 year window that this person gave me this week narrows, then you are in the window where you're not really going to get much done.
I think what you are more likely to see is someone like we see with the IRS Commissioner John Koskinen, is that someone like him who will come take this job because they know that it's just kind of a feather in their cap.
Yeah.
It's a last thing of a career. Not that John Koskinen is going to retire. But
no, but he's 75. I mean, and he told me in the interview I did with him, you know, this is his
Swan song.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know. But yes, this is what he's going to do, and he's going to wrap up his career, although he insists he's going to spend all 5 years there.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's his motivation, is to be able to use this as kind of a cap on his career.
And one last thing I'll just kind of bring up is the who could replace him. So I asked a couple of people those questions, and nobody wants to touch
nobody
it.
Nobody can replace the who.
Nobody can replace the who, right? Roger Daltrey, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see, because Van Roekel in many ways was not the obvious choice to bring in when Vivek Kundra left. So I'm not sure there's an obvious choice to replace him with either.
You write in the story, Lisa Schlosser, the deputy administrator and will be the interim CIO. The White House says they want to move swiftly to fill the federal CIO position. It might not be up to them, though. I mean, it might be up to the whims of the people that they're considering. And following this, I think, will be interesting, not because of the CIO position, but just because of where we are in the window of the administration that we've talked about. And if we get a sense that their first choice thinks about it and then declines, maybe for some of the reasons that we've discussed, and they go to a second choice, what does that look like? Or if they're really, really tight-lipped and play it close to the vest and never give any indication about that to give anybody a chance to try to figure that out.
This administration, unfortunately, is not tight-lipped like that. You saw how quickly Megan Smith leaked out about the CTO. Then all of a sudden,
it's good for us, though.
It was media. As long as we're the ones they give it to, right? Hint,
right,
hint.
Right.
So it's all about, they always like to float those names and see what the reaction is. So I think that's the first key to look for.
Jason Miller's most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Federal CIO Steve Van Roekel leaving his job for a new role at USAID. You can find that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. And we should wrap up the countdown this week, Jason, I think, by congratulating our colleague, Tom Temin, who is learning just today that he's a grandfather. So we can call him Pappy from now on.
You can call me anything you want.
Pappy, tell me about your new grandchild. What is his or her name and all the stats?
Well, I don't know yet, actually. I haven't seen her. This is how new this is.
So we know she's a she.
We know she's a she. I know she weighed 7 pounds, but I'm not sure they've settled on a name.
And mother and father are doing well.
That is wonderful. We congratulate you, Mazel Tov, and all the best to you and your wife and your wonderful, wonderful new granddaughter. Congratulations, my
thank
friend.
Thank you very much.
All the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and the Federal News Countdown back next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose.